UK Wine Show, show number 77, a Beckett's Winery with Paul Langham. On this week's show,
where we are is, it's a bit like an undiscovered country.
And
in the news, Sainsbury's pull out of plastic, Ridgeview win gastronomic prize, and Waitrose scoop Wine Buyer of the Year award.
G'day. Welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 77 for the 16th of November 2007. My name's Chris Scott, and this week we're talking with Paul Langham. Paul has started a Beckett's Winery, and they grow grapes in Wiltshire, just beside Salisbury Plain and Stonehenge. A Beckett's is a relatively new winery with 6 years under their belt. Paul has a unique vantage of being able to look back at the decisions he made at 2001 with a bit of hindsight. We're going to talk about Salisbury and how things are going and what he would do differently. But before we get into that, let's have the news with Jane Scott.
Thanks, Chris. After a three-month trial of an own-label white and a rosé in plastic PET bottles, Sainsbury's is putting the wines back into glass. The supermarket is worried that they won't sell fast enough during the winter when sales of red overtake whites and rosés. Because of the nine-month shelf life of PET, there's a risk the wine won't stay fresh for long enough over the winter months. The wines will, however, be back in plastic during the summer and will be in glass the rest of the year. Next up, English sparkling wine producer Ridgeview has been awarded the prestigious Grand Prix of Gastronomy. The award is given to the person or product that's done the most for gastronomy in the UK in the previous year. The British Academy of Gastronomes was founded by Egon Rone in 1983 to help improve the standard of British food. Normally, this top prize goes to foodies including Jane Grigson, the Roux Brothers, and Prince Charles, nonetheless, for his revival of mutton. And finally, for the fifth year in a row, Waitrose has picked up the International Wine and Spirit Competition's Wine Buyer of the Year award. The winning Waitrose team comprises five Masters of Wine and is headed up by Justin Howard Snade. The team won as a result of their strong performance in this year's competition, with 51 out of the 55 wines submitted winning awards. That's it for this week, but don't forget you can get more detail on these news stories on the news homepage of our website 3050.co.uk. That's it from me. Back over to you, Chris.
Cheers, Jane. Well, congratulations to Waitrose and Tesco's. To Waitrose, well, you do have probably the best range in the supermarkets in the UK. Well, in the UK, Tesco's is vilified by a vocal minority of people and used by the majority. Being selected for European Retailer of the Year indicates not only are they the largest wine retailer in the UK, but they are also innovating. While some may not like their innovations, but they are well thought out and well executed. You may not like the idea of a company committed to PET plastic wine bottles, but as long as there's a solid understanding of the aging limitations of PET bottles, which they have, I think it's okay for high-volume wines sold in a fast-selling supermarket, particularly when you consider the environmental costs of using green glass. So, as long as they manage their stock and supply chains, which, let's face it, Tesco's can, I say, good on you. And while we're on the good on you theme, good on you, Ridgeview. I've been enjoying their sparklers now for a couple of years, and both are superb and consistent. That is, if you can get any of their wines, they are certainly in the elite category of English sparkling wines. If you want to find out more about Ridgeview, I interviewed Mike in Show 24 about a year ago. Next up, we're going to have the interview with Paul Langham, owner of a Beckett's Wine. A Beckett's are a wee bit unusual in that they grow grapes, they have their own branding, but they don't make their own wines. They actually pass them out to English wine producers, or you may know English wine producers better as Chapel Down, Owen Elias, to make the wines. So let's have an interview with Paul Langham. Hi, I'm here with Paul Langham from a Beckett's Winery in Wiltshire, England. How are you, Paul?
I'm very well, thank you, Chris.
Excellent. We're going to be talking a wee bit about your vineyards, your winery in Salisbury, which is a bit of a strange wine producing area for
compared to maybe where most people think English wine's produced.
It's true. Where we are is, it's a bit like an undiscovered country. Back in the dawn of time, English wine, the first two of the major vineyards were in our relative neck of the woods at Hambledon and at Bewley, and the vineyard at Bewley is still in. I mean, it's over 50 years old, so it's not as if we've missed out on something.
But most people think, when they're thinking of English wine, they're thinking Kent, Ways, or down the bottom end of London, the Weald area.
I suppose that's true, but I mean, we've got vineyards in Cornwall now.
Yeah.
You've got vineyards in Yorkshire. So I think the nice thing is you can actually throw the perception or the preconceived idea that vineyards only exist in Kent and Sussex out the window.
How many vineyards are around Wiltshire Ways?
In total, there must be about seven now, I think, in Wiltshire itself.
Yep.
So at least four of those are relatively newly planted. So it's very much changing and growing.
Yeah. What's the reason for it? It's coming over the hill a wee while ago, and I thought I was on the Salisbury Plain. I was expecting quite a desolate area, but it wasn't. It was all sort of almost like rolling countryside. I was a bit surprised.
Well, that is the plain that you've been over. I mean, when the army have finished with it, at times it does look a little desolate. But it's a large area of chalk upland. And when you come off the escarpment, which if you look out from our place, you can see, that then means that you've got the chalk sort of flowing down into the valleys where we are.
Yep.
And we've got a very interesting sort of soil makeup. We're on upper greensand with sort of upper chalk directly underneath it, sort of between 2 and 6 feet sort of down. So for our vines, they have a lovely easy start in greensand. Personally, as we hand planted all of this, it was a far easier job than some folks who have to physically dig a hole. All we had to do was almost sort of push a piece of angle iron in to make a nice easy sort of knife through butter sort of hole, and we could plant. So the vines get an easy start. After that, then they hit the chalk and they've got to start working.
I suppose the nice thing about greensands is it's a bit like chalk, isn't it? But it's more sandy.
Yes, it's very, very free draining, easy for the roots to get through. It's a very good sort of nursery and sort of start off. They then hit the chalk and they've then got to work. Again, you've got the free draining, they've got to fight for water, they've got to fight for nutrients, which is something I think vines really, really enjoy.
The chalk and the greensand, so you've got easy drainage. Do you have problems with water? You know, either too much water or not enough water?
We haven't yet had a problem with not enough water.
What about last year during the drought?
It's fine. I mean, we have this wonderful thing out the back of us, is Salisbury Plain, which is this giant sponge. And in certainly the last 130 years, so the locals tell me, the river at the bottom of the vineyard hasn't run dry. So if there's water in the river, then there's obviously groundwater there.
Yeah.
And the vines are reaching down and the vines will be getting it. So I don't think we've had a water problem that we can concern ourselves with. I think rain is always a challenge. This year we have had a little more rain than most, but we seem to have a rain shadow effect from Salisbury Plain, which means it can be quite often tipping down in Devizes, 4 miles north, and we remain dry. So I'm encouraged that we don't seem to be getting sort of drowned, which is an experience I think one or two vineyards may have had this year.
And looking at your vineyard, I noticed that it's actually quite steep, your slope. You're on quite a reasonable slope there.
You do feel it when you're walking back up, believe you me. And if you're walking up and down the rows, putting the wires up, believe you me, by the back of the end of the day, your calves are feeling a little sore.
Yeah, you've done a bit of work.
Yeah, absolutely.
But you're not facing south. You're actually facing east, aren't you?
We're almost east facing. It's just the lie of the land. I mean, when we discovered the site, it was an abandoned fruit farm. Mm-hmm. And digging around with history, I mean, it's been a fruit farm for 40 years. Prior to that, it was orchards and a bit of market gardening as well. So our hunch was, well, that can't be too bad.
Yep.
It's got good soil. It's got good drainage. The aspect in itself helps because we're sheltered from the prevailing westerly winds. They tend to sort of blow over the top of the vineyard. It also means you get all the morning sun.
Yep.
So, yeah, the sun rises, and that really does sort of bode well. I'd rather have early morning sun than wait for the afternoon and into the evening to sort of carry on, because you get the early heat. One of the advantages of being on greensand, it's a light soil, it warms up quickly.
Yeah.
So there's a lot to be said for getting the soil warm, creates a good microclimate, and the vines will prosper better. Albeit, if I could tilt the site 15 degrees, I'd be very happy.
Out there with the shovel and spade digging it around.
I'm afraid I'm not quite in the sort of the creator mode, so I don't think I'm in a position to do that, sadly.
Fair enough. What sort of grape varieties are you growing here?
We've got five, four principal ones and one purely for a defined purpose. On the whites, we've got Pinot Auxois, Reitensteiner, and Sauval Blanc. Mm-hmm. On the red, it's Pinot Noir, with a very small amount of Dunkelfelder, which is really there purely for colour, nothing more than that.
Pinot Auxois, that's a wee bit unusual. I have heard of the odd person growing it a wee bit, but not really a lot. What's it like as a grape variety, and where did it come from?
It's Alsace in origin. It is a cousin of Chardonnay, and seems to do what you would expect a Chardonnay to do in this country. We're using it principally for sparkling wine and some into our blended white, mm-hmm. still white wine. It's reliable. It produces, for my liking, too much foliage, but you can't have everything in life.
Yep.
And has a nice tendency of getting late botrytis, which has been quite useful.
Have you let it get a bit of botrytis? Not because you don't do a late harvest or a dessert wine, do you?
We're not doing a late harvest or dessert wine as yet, but we're using it for sort of boosting sugar levels in it, because we get acceptable sugar from it. I'd love to say it's outstanding. I mean, there are other varieties that will produce a higher level of sugar, but it seems to give interesting characteristics into the wine, and it's well used in France as a base for sparkling. So it seemed a reasonable choice.
Is that the Alsace Cremant?
Correct, yeah. I mean, if you have your time again, perhaps we would have substituted the Auxois for the Chardonnay and just bitten the bullet from day one.
Yeah.
But we sort of debated over that and came down in favour of this one.
Fair enough. A couple of great varieties you're not growing, which is a bit surprising. Well, three, really. Bacchus and Ortega for the whites, which are normally a fairly solid English grape varieties, and Rondo for the red. You haven't gone for either of those.
Mm. Ortega, I think the jury's out on that one for us.
Mm-hmm.
So that's probably why it's not there. I don't know. We did do, as any good business researcher should do, an awful lot of sampling before we made the commitment, or at least buying wine and trying it on other people. Our view on Bacchus is great nose. Loved it, really captivated us. But you found that unless it was made almost near perfectly, you lost all the Bacchus characteristics. And we found it was so difficult to actually see that consistent Bacchus taste that we thought, it seems unreliable. And we lived with it in the sense of, trying it over a period of time. And we came down in view that aim to get that particular style and taste, which is what people would want. And after a while, we began to think, it's not quite us. So
personally,
doing what we do, you have to get behind this.
Yeah.
It's very much a heart and soul thing. And it's also a business, and you've got to be sensible. And that's it. But we felt we weren't comfortable with it.
Okay.
Similar thing applies to the Rondo. I think a teeny tiny amount of Rondo at the back end of a red is a very good way of almost finishing the picture in terms of how the wine is constructed. But Rondo used extensively to our minds comes through, I can describe it purely as, it's almost like a sort of a coal-like taste.
Coal dust or coal?
Coal dust. Something about it that just doesn't work, and combined with too much wood, us really does become an unpleasant or less than palatable, shall I say, sort of prospect.
And I've seen it blended very nicely, and I've had it by itself and it creates a nice reasonably fleshy red. I thought, but
I think there are occasions it does. I mean, I also don't particularly like the prospect of having an animal in the vineyard, because this thing grows 20 metres in a year. You've got to hack it back into shape. and you've got to do a lot of green harvesting,
yep,
because it wants to crop as if it's going out of fashion.
Okay.
And with that in mind, we thought, you know, we'd rather work positively with vines, and that just seemed, it seemed a combination of things that sort of led us towards Pinot.
Fair enough. You've been making a bit of rosé. I quite liked it at the English trade tasting I went to about 6 months ago.
Mm.
In fact, I liked it enough we listed it and sold a wee bit of it. So there is a bit of a bias in this podcast. But what made you think about trying rosé?
We wanted to do this for 2005, but it was just getting enough capacity into the system. And it's always been something that we've been angling for, and we had sufficient volume, so we thought, let's do it. We were delighted with the results. I mean, getting a silver at the national competition this year, English and Welsh Wine of the Year, was absolutely great. The fact is that the wine that won the Waitrose trophy also got a silver. We must have missed the top prize by a whisker.
Yeah, yeah. Who got the Waitrose top prize?
As a vineyard in Cornwall called Polygoon. They got the Waitrose sort of, I think it's a salver or trophy. I can't remember exactly what it is.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just great. And the reaction we've had from folks has been brilliant. We've had lots of additional customers come through as a result. A number of outlets in London have come on stream because of what we've got.
Yeah.
Which is great to suddenly become visible to them, because the wine's reputation is going ahead, as opposed to having to do the more traditional sales and marketing approach. I mean, it's fabulous.
Yeah, no, it's very good. And rosé, I think a lot of wine people, you know, when they're talking about English wine, they're really big up the sparkling, but I've had some really good rosés. You know, without English rosé, I still wouldn't be a big fan of rosé, I don't think.
I think there's something we can do. It's just, it's a unique combination of sort of flavour, style, and it just works. There's a number of good English rosés I can think of, and I mean, I would certainly rate ours strongly in with the best of them. And it's just, it's come out great. I think that's the thing that we're going to see over the next few years. You're going to see an exploration of growth in rosé, the continued march of sparkling, and you're also going to see improving reds year on year.
So you, as a vineyard, you guys haven't been going very long. When did you start?
We planted all this in April 2001.
Okay, so you've had, what, four vintages now?
We're just about to pick the fifth.
Fifth one, yeah, because this we're actually recording in end of September, almost beginning of October, last day in September, isn't it, today?
It is indeed.
So you'll be out in the vineyards picking tomorrow?
We've got the Pinot coming off tomorrow, yes.
And how's the season going?
The season hasn't been that bad.
Because it was fairly wet for a while.
It was, but we've done, I think, very well. The rain shadow effect has helped. We've had less. I think the downside for us this year was June was a little on the cool side.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, I think everyone was complaining about it. And the Saval, which last year did 11 tons for us, which was just a monstrous amount of grapes off the vines, has come out with probably only a couple of tons, because the cold has it helps finish off the flowers, for want of a better word. Saval tends to dislike trying to flower in the middle of a sort of a relatively cool patch. But the vines are probably going to appreciate a rest anyway. But the quality of the grapes we've got out there at the moment is pretty wow.
Yeah.
So we're going to be quite selective with what we do with it. But otherwise, got no complaints. Pinot is absolutely covered with the stuff, so very, very happy.
Okay, everything looks pretty healthy. When I had a quick look at the top of your vineyard on the way in, it looked fairly happy. Not too much disease.
No, I think was it about 5 weeks ago, we could see downy mildew attempting to get its way in. So we got out the special substances and hit it hard, and that seems to have worked. So all in all, very happy. No complaints.
In Salisbury is a grape growing region, you know, do you have to worry about frost a lot? You know, like normally frost is a big problem in some of the regions.
I think anywhere in the UK you're going to have to accept that frost is a potential hazard, whether you like it or not.
How do you manage frost here?
We take advantage of the topography. We look at we're on a hill, we've got a river at the bottom, and that's got a floodplain, so we know that's where the coldest air is going to roll to.
Yep.
So that's in our favour. We also have our own frost monitoring system here. it basically comprises a range of thermometers that report back to me if it's getting close to sort of the freezing point or a point where I think we have to take action. Alarms go off, and it's a bit like having small children again. I get out of bed and I go down the bottom of the vineyard where we have a large selection of oil drums,
right.
And we set fire to these. It looks quite impressive from the top of the hill, actually. And basically our objective is to draw air vertically, so hot air rising is then going to draw air down to replace it, so that we keep the air moving through the vineyard.
Mm-hmm.
The aim is to sort of keep the air moving so that frost doesn't have the ability to settle.
So you're not actually trying to warm the vineyard up at all, you're just trying to keep it moving.
To be honest, I have seen the temperature go up, but I cannot say empirically whether that's due to our activities.
Yep.
What I do see is that you then feel a breeze on your face because you've got all this air rising.
Yep.
So that tells me that I am keeping the air moving. And that is the only way that I can feasibly control what we're doing.
You haven't looked at spraying water on them, or some people use latex like rubber?
They do. I think for us, where we are, the site in terms of headland would be classed as a little compact, and trying to spray water at sort of 1 a.m, just prior to freezing, I wouldn't really want to find myself parked in the river. Because I wasn't concentrating. So that is
you know, too steep.
It's not so much too steep. There's just not sufficient headland turning at the top and bottom for sort of operating late at night when you may not be at your most optimum freshness.
Yeah.
Which is one note for the future when we plant more, you know, allow a lot more headroom.
to turn around.
Yes. Admittedly, when we started this, we had a far smaller tractor. But we soon realised that when you put the sprayer on the back and filled it up and the tractor wanted to tip back, that you needed to come up with an alternative plan.
Yeah, sure. Okay, what do you think the best area thing about being in Salisbury and the worst thing about being in Salisbury from a wine producing point of view?
I think in terms of best is the soils. I mean, we have absolutely great soils. They are, you know, on a par with what you get in Champagne, as far as I can tell, based on what I've seen from geological maps. That's great. I think on the downside for us is we do get hit with some of the westerly storms, perhaps earlier than others may. And obviously, the further east you go, there's more chance of the impact of those storms sort of fading out. But our rainfall, we've got a local meteorologist, and our rainfall certainly shows to be sort of below average. For the area and below average for the country, so it's not doom and gloom, that's for sure. We wouldn't be doing this, that's for sure.
Some of the vineyards down Southampton ways, they're there partly because they get less cloud cover. I was reading some meteorological stuff a few months ago, and it was sort of implying as you moved further and further away from the coast, you land up with more and more cloud cover, so you got less sunlight hours. Is it your experience, or
I think there is some truth to that. Also, I was talking to someone who owns a vineyard down that part of the world. Because we're not being close to the sea, you have the cooling effect of the sea, which is why, you know, if you're on the Isle of Wight or around there, that means it's a little different. So it swings and roundabouts. You might see more of the sky, but it tends to be a little cooler. Also, I think it was 2005. A number of vineyards in Hampshire got well and truly walloped by frost. And what happened, it was a particularly strange night that in the Solent, it got very cold and the frost came up the various river valleys and found all these vineyards. We were absolutely fine here because we were inland and we didn't have that sort of strange quirk. But a number of guys, their vineyards were just completely wiped out. And in the space of a few days, they'd walk out and look at sort of yellowing buds, and that was it.
Not enough time to reset.
Unfortunately, no. It's sort of a one-shot opportunity here, really.
I think we'll wrap it up there, Paul. Thanks very much for your time.
Pleasure.
Hope you enjoyed that interview with Paul. I thought it was quite interesting looking at some of the decisions he's made. Also, the soils looks like a reasonably decent region for growing grape, particularly in the rain shadow of the Salisbury Plain. Good soils, so maybe we'll see a few more vineyards popping up in Salisbury over the next wee while. And don't forget our monthly poll. As part of the monthly poll, I try and drill into the issues behind the poll in my monthly newsletter that we send out. So I thought I'd give you my notes in this week's show. Don't forget, the poll question is, the UK government advises drinkers to drink no more than 3 to 4 units of alcohol a day for men and 2 to 3 units for women, where a unit is about 8 grams of alcohol. Would you say you regularly drink more, drink less, drink about that amount? Don't know. Not sure which count, what counts as a unit, and I don't think I worry about it. My notes for this, which went out in the November monthly newsletter, are these. Recent press releases by the Centre for Public Health gave a rude awakening to many wine drinkers in the UK. In a surprising set of results, it pointed out that while Liverpool and Manchester have England's highest harmful drinkers at around 8.1 and 8.9% respectively of the adult population, it was the affluent areas that had the most hazardous drinking, with Runnymede, Harrogate, Surrey, all at around 26%, Guildford, Middlesex, Mole Valley, Waverley and Leeds, all above 25% of the adult population. But what are the limits of harmful and hazardous drinking, and what do they mean? Sensible drinking is a rather poorly defined and researched level. It first appeared in the UK in a 1987 pamphlet called The Limit. It was described as the amount to which people should limit their drinking if they want to avoid damaging health effects. Hazardous drinking, on the other hand, is drinking above the recognised sensible level, but not yet experiencing harm. The risk of harm from drinking above sensible levels increases the more that you drink and the more often you drink over these levels. And harmful drinking? Harmful drinking is levels that leads to significant harm to the physical and mental health, and at levels that they cause substantial harm to others. Examples include liver damage, cirrhosis, dependence on alcohol, stress or aggravation in the family. I think the limits, particularly of hazardous drinking, it doesn't hurt, but it's above sensible, and sensible is poorly defined, but they know it doesn't hurt you. So they're the limits. By the sounds of it, harmful drinking is certainly not where you want to be, and sensible drinking is probably a good target. So what are the limits in the UK, according to the UK government? For men, you should drink no more than 21 units of alcohol per week, and no more than 4 units in any one day. Between 22 and 50 units a week, a man is considered a hazardous drinker, and above 51, you're considered a harmful drinker. Men who regularly drink over 8 units a day are the highest risk of such alcohol-related harm. Women should drink no more than 14 units of alcohol per week, and no more than 3 units in any one day. Between 15 and 35 units, a woman is considered a hazardous drinker, and above 36 units, they're considered a harmful drinker. Women who regularly drink over 6 units a day are the highest risk of such alcohol-related harm. But what is a unit? The UK advice to the public is based on a term known as a unit. 1 unit alcohol is defined as 10 millilitres or 1 centilitre of alcohol by volume, ABV, or 8 grams by weight of pure alcohol. I published a table showing the percentage ABV versus how much to drink for each unit. The key values, I think, are, particularly for wine, for women, if you drink 300 mils of 10% alcohol, that's 3 units, or 200 mils of 15% alcohol is 3 units. For 4 units a day, or for 4 units, that's 400 millilitres of 10% alcohol or 267 millilitres of 15% alcohol. So depending on the alcohol level, the ABV level, it's between a third of a bottle of wine and just over half a bottle of wine. For women at 7 units, the hazardous drinking is 700 millilitres of 10% alcohol or 467 millilitres of 15% alcohol. So just under a bottle of 10% wine for women. For blokes, it is, for 8 units, it is 800 millilitres, just over a bottle of 10% alcohol, or 533 millilitres of 15% alcohol. So that gives you an idea of what the different limits are. We note on pregnant women, it is known that a lot of alcohol can damage a developing baby. According to the Department of Health's pregnancy book, and this is an extract from there. Heavy or frequent drinking can seriously harm your baby's development. When you drink, alcohol reaches your baby through the placenta, but your baby cannot process it as fast as you can and is exposed to greater levels of alcohol for longer than you are. And too much exposure to alcohol can seriously affect your baby's development and cause fetal alcohol syndrome. Children with this have restricted growth, heart defects, facial abnormalities, and learning and behavioural difficulties. The UK Chief Medical Officer advises that in general rule, pregnant women or women trying to conceive should avoid drinking alcohol. If you do choose to drink to protect your baby, you should not drink more than 1 or 2 units of alcohol once or twice a week, and you should not get drunk. But what do other countries say? Because other countries have completely different points of view on this. So we've explained the UK government's, but let's have a look at what Australia and New Zealand say. They use a concept called a standard drink. It's similar to a unit, but it's based on 10 grams of alcohol a day, while the UK system uses 8 grams. Don't worry, I've converted the Australia and New Zealand standard units into UK units so that we can all use that. Just to recap, in the UK, sensible drinking is 2 to 3 units for women and 3 to 4 for men. For Australia, men should drink no more than 3.2 units a day on average and never more than 4.8 units a day. So a bit more in Australia is considered sensible drinking. And women should drink no more than 1.6 units on average and never more than 3.2 units in one day. So again, a wee bit lower and a wee bit higher. And they also say that everybody should have 1 or 2 alcohol-free days. In New Zealand, ALAC, the Alcohol Liquor Advisory Council, advises that men should drink no more than 2.4 units on a day on average and never more than 4.8 units a day. And women should drink no more than 1.6 on average and no more than 3.2 units in one day. So similar to Australia, but slightly lower for men on average. And again, they suggest 1 or 2 days should be completely drink-free. So in New Zealand and Australia, they say it's almost 5 units a day for blokes, as opposed to in England we say 4. So a wee bit different, 25% more in Australia. So maybe that's a reason to move out to Aussie. I know this is a bit dry, but I hope it's tried to put some of the news stories that have been coming out into context. So, for example, on Tuesday this week, a group of doctors were calling for higher duties on alcohol to limit drinking. Now, I don't know if that will really work, because higher duties on alcohol will encourage more people to import wine from France. They'll just jump the ship, get more wine, and all that's going to have, customers and revenue are going to miss out on tax revenue, and there's not going to be a lot gained from it. So I'm not sure if putting taxes up is a good thing while you've got a country, while you're surrounded by countries with quite a lenient approach to taxing of alcohol. Bit of a serious commentary on units, but I think it gives some decent context. At least now I've got a reasonable understanding from this research of what people are saying. And when some of the press go, oh, hazardous drinking, hazardous drinking, all it means is it's a grey area where you're above what they consider an area that's sensible, i.e. you're not going to get drunk, and below an area where you're going to be hurting yourself. But next week we say goodbye to units and we say hello, port. Christmas is on its way, and I'm a sucker for the festive season. And while I drink port all year round, it's Christmas time, and we all go gaga for port. So this week we're going to be talking with small niche port house, Rose's Port. Not in the supermarkets, but they are available in the restaurants and independent wine merchants throughout the UK. And their 10-year-old Rosie is a personal favourite of mine, and I get to taste it quite a bit at tastings. We use it a lot in our tastings. And it currently ranks 3rd as our favourite wine in 3050's top 30 ranking of wines that we taste in tastings. So quite popular there. So until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Jane Scott, recorded and edited by Chris Scott, and the news is researched by Sandra Clement. To listen to other shows, visit www.ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.